You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Thanks for tuning into the Southern Way podcast on the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mark Haslam, and on this show, we cover all things hunting culture across the South, tips, tactics, and skills to better your pursuit. And of course, we'll do things the Southern Way. All right, welcome back, Southern Way Podcast. This week, I'm going to talk a little bit about buying land and navigating the process of what to consider when you're looking at land, listings online, when you're talking with agents, listing agents, someone, a licensed salesperson that might help you and represent you as a buyer. What to think about, what to consider, and the questions to ask, and that whole process. Because if you're going to be, if you're looking at buying land right now in the South, it's gonna cost you a significant amount of money, as much as, you know, buying a home or more. So it, you know, real estate is one of the largest purchases, investments that anyone in their lifetime typically makes. So, you know, it can be done, but you just got to take your time and navigate through it to protect yourself and protect your investment. So I want to cover that real quick. Things to look for, things to avoid. First, kind of want to go get through a couple things right now. I know last week we talked, I talked a lot about scouting and, you know, scouting bucks and what to do. To kind of jumpstart that process, so you're not waiting until, you know, mid late summer, trying to pick up on some deer. Food plots should be on everyone's radar as far as, you know, planning out time when they're going to plant. I'm going to cover this soon, probably next week. Kind of a breakdown as far as different strategy for a planning, but here's some kind of top level things just to be thinking about. Soil temperature is very important, and a lot of people, if they put some seed in the ground the past 30 days, it probably wasn't warm enough. The seed will still germinate, but it's not going to produce. It's not going to germinate to its fullest, the plant. So pay attention to. Just simply Google it, soil temp, kind of where you are in your local area, and figure out when it should be. But, you know, here in the Deep South, you're looking at the next 30 days getting out there, mostly just depending on rainfall. Mississippi State University has an outstanding guide. It's called the Guide to Planting. It's the Southeastern Food Supplemental Food Plot Guide, and they've got one that's like a quick kind of rundown sheet that's just a one page, but they have another PDF file that takes a little bit of digging on their website, but you can find it. It's like 20 or 30 pages, and it's a full breakdown of, you know, warm season annuals that people planting right now, cool season annuals that people will start planting in October, you know, September, October, early November maybe, and then perennials, which if you want some perennials on the ground, you're not going to plant them right now, but you can start planning as far as where you want them, and start looking at when, how to do it, and then maybe start kind of budging as far as cost. One suggestion I always have for people is plant more than what you think. If you want to plant this field and that field, plant some more. I mean, just people usually go a little bit too small. A food plot is there for a, you can plant a food plot for several different reasons. It could be nutrition, or it could be to kill, just to kind of give them in an area for a kill plot, or some kind of mix of both. But plant more than what you think. Last thing you want to do is put all that time, money, and energy into it just to have, a herd of deer come through and just wipe it all clean or knock it out. By the, if you're going to go to that expense and that time with your equipment or borrowing equipment or whatever you're doing, hand, drilling it in with a no-till drill, or, hand spreading it and dragging something over it, whatever it is, spend a little bit more in buy that extra bag, plant more than what you think. And lastly, use a seclusion cage. Just go to Home Depot, your local home and garden store, buy some kind of chicken wire, hog wire, about 4 feet tall, and put some posts in the ground. It does not have to be fancy. It does not have to be, I mean, you could just get some tall wooden stakes, put it in the ground, and you want to have a diameter of, I like to have that diameter about minimum 3 feet. Sometimes 3 feet is entirely too small. 4 to 5 feet, because you will be surprised how far a deer can actually get in there. If you don't have a seclusion cage, it's going to be almost impossible to figure out exactly what happened to your plot if it does not succeed, or if it's just not completely lush. But having that seclusion cage, you're seeing the browse pressure. You will see exactly, because you're essentially just trapping off a section that is not getting touched by deer. The deer can't reach it. Therefore, you've got the evidence as far as what the plant's full capacity looks like at that particular moment without deer getting into it, because they're the ones that are going to wipe it out. And hogs, of course. I don't have any kind of hogs right now in my place, but people with hogs, you will see exactly, what they're doing to it. So, lastly, a couple other things, deer surveys. Right now, if you're trying to get at, planning ahead for deer season, put some cameras up. Put some cameras up on some open fields, or even start to run some little bait station sites. Figure out, how many does you've got in this section or that section. Bucks, my bucks, my 1 and 2 year olds are just starting to kind of break out with some growth. My 3 and 4, 5 year old bucks plus, they're already starting to show signs of thickness, and you can tell they're going to be some big antler deer. But of course, you can look at their body size and tell what they are. But start that process. Hang some cameras up, and you may be surprised that you've got way more deer on the landscape. So think about that. And so let's just get rolling right here. And this is navigating agents and brokers and land sales. So this current market that we're in is it's pretty wild right now. And I should just kind of slow down and back up for a second. I've been in real estate, that's been my career. After getting out of college in 2005, I went right into real estate, got my license in Georgia, and then my license in South Carolina, where I still hold both of them. So, the first couple years, end of 05, going into 2008, real estate was booming for the most part. We were still riding pretty high on those early 2000 residential market, where people were flipping a lot of houses. All those home and garden, flipping shows were very popular. And there's a lot of markets where their, you know, values were starting to peak. But of course, the real estate market crashed ultimately because of financing loans. There were some incredibly, horribly written loan packages given out to people, 90%, 100% financing. And people were basically were given real estate loans, mostly residential driven, that they were not qualified, that they could not pay for. And it caught up the banks and ultimately we had a crash. So, and that, you know, that led into a pretty good slowdown in the land sales that, you know, at, after that crash, you know, just like everything else, real estate slowed down. So fast forward to where we are right now, 24 years ago, we had a monumental shift in the real estate market. That is probably going to be studied. I mean, it's going to be studied the rest of my life. But essentially what happened, everyone's seeing this, in, you know, these all this real estate stuff on social media, talking pundits, talking heads. But essentially what happened is interest rates were cut extremely low 4 years ago to try to stimulate the economy. I mean, it's, at least it's in my professional opinion that our government completely failed us during COVID, during the quote pandemic, CDC, none of these entities and agencies and institutions, none of them knew how to handle this. And it was apparent, you know, this time 4 years ago, shoot, man, you know, mid late April, we kind of knew what we had with COVID. Yes, some people were going to die, but ultimately, it wasn't going to be the Black Plague. But so they cut the rates low to try to spur the market on. Well, people started buying, and no one in real estate, and I can say this because I'm in real estate, and I was in real estate then. Across the board in real estate, whether you were residential, commercial, land sales, whatever it is, you knew that there was going to be a big shift in the market, and most brokerages did not know what was going to happen. 4 years ago, right now, late April of 2020, no one knew what was going to happen. And I don't think I didn't come across one person that said it at the time, and I haven't come across one person that claims to have predicted this in hindsight, that the market was going to fire up. You know, I was thinking, like a lot of people, that people were going to sit tight. We got this pandemic, things are shutting down, and we don't know what the economy is going to do. Everyone knew the economy was going to have some major issues. So why would people buy real estate? Well, with the rates being locked in, with the rates going down low, people got locked in, and that spurred on all kinds of purchases, and also spurred on a big portion of what we had as far as the problem is that there was so many investors, so many big entities, hedge funds that were just gobbling up properties. And that's what drove the value up. So right now we're in a market where interest rates skyrocketed up. Now, of course, these rates at 6-7, and it's looking like they could even reach about 8%. This is where interest rates were when I first got in the business 18 years ago. They were 8%, 8.5%. So it's, you know, interest rates have always been relatively high. You know, boomers were dealing with interest rates in the 80s. That were in the teens. So that's one thing, but it's the value of real estate, the value of land, the value of dirt that has gone up, and that's inflated, and that's not looking to come down anytime soon. Real estate, for the most part, does not trend down. It only trends up. It might stabilize for a little bit. Yeah, you can find some isolated dips here and there. I know there's a lot of real estate coming to the market around Orlando, around Disney World. And that's a lot of that has to do with the Airbnb STVR, but that's an isolated pocket. In general, real estate does not trend down, does not lose value. It's going to maintain, stabilize, and only increase. So right now, you know, values of dirt in land is at an all-time high. I mean, I'm looking for people to buy to buy some land in Georgia and South Carolina right now, and you can't find, it is hard to find land that is in the 3,000 per acre bracket. Most land is 4,000 plus, which is crazy. You know, pre-pandemic, you could find land that was 2,000 a square, 2,000, excuse me, 2,000 acre or even less. So values have increased, but don't be alarmed by that. Like I said, values aren't going to trend down. Dirt only appreciates, but there's some things to consider, other factors. Dirt only appreciates, but there's a lot of other factors that can affect the value. Rates, we already kind of talked about that. Agents right now, we're seeing, as one would think, we're seeing a decrease in the amount of licensed real estate agents across the board. That happens with markets. When they trend up, we have an influx of agents. It's very easy to get a license. It's a very low barrier of entry. When business is good, we have an uptick of agents. When business goes down, people get out of the real estate business. Right now, we're seeing a little bit of a decrease in agents, which is good. That's a good thing. And we saw that with a 2007, 8, 9 market crash. We had a ton of agents that got out, and that's a good thing for the business. A lot of sellers are just, you know, stuck, and they're, you know, it's hard for a lot of sellers to realize what the market's currently doing because their mind's still in, you know, 3 and 4 and 2 years ago when the market peaked as far as value. So when you're looking at buying land, or if you're looking at, you know, of course, I've talked a lot about so far about residential real estate and real estate in general, because all that plays in buying land, buying hunting land, buying recreational, timber tracts, the real estate market, it's all tied in together. But when you're looking at buying land, just like any other piece of real estate, you need to have representation, whether you do your homework and you can represent yourself, or you have a buyer broker to represent you. And typically, you know, I know there's a lot of headlines out there as far as the, you know, National Association of Realtors and the commission structure, but typically the seller is going to pay both sides of the commission. And if they aren't asking, if they're not offering that, put it in the contract, because that's not going to be a deal killer. With the value of dirt, it's not going to be a deal killer, and you need to have representation. The last thing you want to do is to be a buyer and to have the listing agent represent you and the seller. It happens all the time. It happens all the time with a dual agency where you have one agent that is in contact with buyer and seller, and they're, you know, learning how low the seller will go and how much the buyer will pay. How does that make sense? It happens all the time, and it'll be a disservice to someone. Not, you know, it might be one side or the other, but it'll be a disservice to someone. You know, when you're looking at an agent to represent you buying land is very specific, as we all know. Hunting, wildlife, there's been a huge uptick in agents in general, because real estate has been good, especially land sales. I mean, land might slow down, but land sales has been good. And so what have we seen over the past 10, 15 years with land sales? We've seen a massive growth in outdoor hunting branded brokerages that have, you know, a deer in their logo, or deer in their name. That's their branding. And branding, man, it's marketing. It's all about marketing. And, you know, you just got to keep in mind that that does not mean that those agents, those brokerages, are any more qualified because they work for that brokerage, because Typically, that's not the case. People get their license and brokers will hire them because the broker is making a certain percentage off of every dollar that that agent sells. The split could be 80-20, meaning the agent gets 80%, broker gets 20%. It could be 70-30. And as you increase your sales and you sell more volume, you can negotiate a higher split, maybe a 90-10 split. So I say all that because as long as someone's, capable, most brokers are going to hire them. So I'm not saying that those brokerages that brand themselves in the outdoor space or the hunting space, I'm not saying they're not knowledgeable, but everyone there is not going to be the most knowledgeable to represent you on a purchase. So here's some things to consider when you're looking at an agent, talking with an agent, as far as trying to find a property for you. One, I would say right off the bat, experience in sales. How long have they been in the real estate business? What is their background in real estate? Because if they just got their license 6 months ago, and maybe they had a sale, it's they're going to be very green, and a lot of their success when you're brand new in real estate, a lot of your success is going to come down to, are you being mentored, and does that agent have a sounding board to be able to get advice from? Because no matter what state you're in, getting your real estate license, you're it's they're not training you to negotiate. They're not training you to be able to find good deals and a work through a contract, all the way from the initial offer, counter offers, negotiation, going on a contract, due diligence, financing, the loan package, the closing attorney, and getting it closed. You don't learn that in real estate school. You learn all the other junk that doesn't really help you get there. So don't get me started on that. That's something different. But you should have someone, know someone that has some experience in real estate sales. Like I said, I've heard land consultants that do consulting work. I've heard them, they always like to joke that just, anybody and everybody gets in a land consultant. They hunt, they do a little habitat work, they plant some food plots, and all of a sudden they're a consultant. Because anybody can just claim to be a consultant. And I've covered that before in a previous podcast. But the other side to it is in real estate, it's funny how every consultant becomes a real estate agent. They're out consulting. Maybe they went to school for it. They've got a biology degree, a wildlife biologist degree. Well, all of a sudden, they get a real estate license because it's very easy, low barrier of entry. And all of a sudden, they're a land sales agent. Now, they know how to plant the best food plot, how to cut the trees and all. But as far as real estate, like I said at the top of the show, buying real estate is one of the largest investment expenses that anyone is going to make in their lifetime. It's not like buying a truck. It's not like buying a boat that is going to depreciate, although boats and some trucks have maintained some value. I sold a boat for 4 years. I think it was the summer of 2020. Or 21, but I know I think it was summer 20. And I wish we had kept that a little bit longer because that value would have gone up maybe 20,000-30,000. But that's something. That's a side note. But talk to them, feel them out. Don't just simply ask them, hey, how long have you been in real estate? Talk to them. Ask them where they work. Ask them where their bread and butter knowledge is, because if they're licensed in the state of Mississippi, do they know the entire state of Mississippi? Well, I'm licensed in Georgia and South Carolina, and I don't know the entire state. So I'm not going to be qualified to represent people in the entire state. And that, translates a lot to some agents, they'll represent a client anywhere in the state. They might be working in, Atlanta selling condos in Buckhead, but they'll represent someone buying a beach house down St. Simons or on Tybee Island, and they're not qualified. They don't know the market. Get a referral from someone. So if you're talking with an agent in one state, they're maybe not in that area, ask them for a referral. Ask them for another qualified agent that maybe they know personally they can set you up with. When you're talking with an agent, this is why it's so important. You know, here's some things that you got to consider whether you have representation or not. You know, negotiations, making that first offer. You know, the best approach is to have comparable sales to understand the market and to understand, you know, what type of seller are you dealing with. If you have a seller that has just put a price tag on a property, and we're seeing this across the board, it happens everywhere. A seller just puts a price on a property, and that's what they want for it. That's what they deem the value to be. Real estate is only worth what someone's willing to pay. And I will repeat that. Real estate is only worth what someone's willing to pay. So if someone says, hey, this property is worth $500,000, if no one's coming along to pay that, it's not worth $500,000. If you have an offer on the table for $450,000, that's probably what it's worth. And as a side note, appraisals are just a piece of paper. Appraisals, whether you know it's a seller does it or it's done by the bank for, you know, financing purposes, an appraisal for real estate is just simply an estimation, a high level estimation. That's all it is. It is nothing that is specific that this is what the property will get. Negotiation in real estate is an art, and there's a way of doing it. Kind of size up all factors in the situation to make the offer a certain way, make it strong, you know, have some things open, whatever it might be. Try to feel out the seller as far as what they want to get out of the property or what their needs are. You know, like for instance, let's say that you're trying to buy a tract of land and the seller lives on it. He's got a house on it. Maybe he's retiring or he's downsizing and the property's just too much for him. The house is too much. And maybe he's downsizing to be closer to family or whatever it is. If you learn something like that, make him an offer and give him a sale lease back to where you buy the property, you own the land, you own the house, but you're giving him a sale lease back and make it for nothing or make it very low, the lease rate, but maybe grant him the right to remain in the house for a month or two so that he can kind of close on it, get the funds from it, and then figure out his next move. And he's not having to worry about, you know, where he's going to land next, something like that. That's a great tactic to try to get, you know, try to win out the contract. If there's a lot of people involved, or, you know, some other interest. Due diligence, whether you're doing due diligence ahead of making the offer, which a lot of times, well, you know, you definitely need to do that. But when you go into contract on a property, you should have a termination period where you're going to do a little extra research, try to figure out, you know, is this a good investment? Here's some things to consider when buying land as far as due diligence. Right off the board, out of the gate, you want to see if the current ownership has a survey. If they don't have a survey, if the properties aren't marked definitively with, you know, some fresh markings or something that is absolutely, cut in the woods, then you need to get a survey done. And you can put that in the offer, ask the seller to do it, or try to get that done during due diligence, especially if there's a question. That's establishing and maintaining property lines is very important when you own land. I'll get to that down towards the end. Exploring the neighborhood, you know, every tract of land, if you were to take a 200-acre parcel and you put that 200-acre parcel in this county or this state or that state, the value of it's, of course, going to be different as far as price, but the wildlife value, is going to be tremendously different. You know, does that 200 acres butt up against wetland, a swamp that no one's going to be able to, no one will be able to touch? Does that 200 acres butt up to a well-managed, you know, plantation? There was a listing. There's a listing right now. It's on a contract in Low Country, South Carolina, Jasper County, and it's I think it's like it's about 800 acres. And the real value of it is that you're that that property is surrounded by long-term, high-level wildlife and land management. And it's in an area where this where that's the highest and best use. That property is worth far more being in that quote, you know, being in that neighborhood than if that property was somewhere else. You know, do you butt up against does that property butt up against commercial developed areas? If you start to trend closer to commercial developments, there is a risk down the road that you know, local governments will change zoning anytime they want to. And, you know, you see that a lot outside of cities that are growing. All of a sudden, agricultural land, agricultural zoned land, that the highest and best use is to grow trees or crops or have cows. When it gets rezoned from agricultural to like multifamily or industrial, the value skyrockets. All of a sudden, you're not dealing with, you know, maybe someone that's got a little extra cash that wants to have a hunting property kind of, you know, close by to where they live and work. Now you're dealing with developers, regional and national developers that want to come in and build an apartment complex or some rental units or a strip center or, you know, anchored grocery store with a Dollar General out parcel or even industrial. Warehousing space, flex space, you're all of a sudden, that's a big shift in the values and the highest and best use. So now, with that being said, you buy a tract of land when it's zoned agricultural, and then if it gets rezoned, you can make some money that way. But a long-term play, when that starts to develop around your local neighborhood, the wildlife value is going to suffer. Now, you might be able to sell that farm and make a lot of extra money and then go buy something bigger and better, but the wildlife value for that particular property is going to shrink. When you have that development down, there's less game moving around. That's kind of just stating the obvious, but explore your neighbors. You know, how do they hunt? Is your neighbor's land in a dog hunting club? Do they hunt at all? Is it a shooting preserve? There's a lot of different factors to look into. Look them up, figure them out, call them, or better yet, have your agent bird dog this. Have your agent that's representing you, that's making a commission off this, have them bird dog that and figure that out. Because just like buying a house and where you live, you want to know. You'd like to know who your neighbors are, who you're dealing with. Is it going to be someone you want to live next to? When you buy land and you're putting all that sweat equity in your property with whatever you're doing, whether it's deer management, turkeys, or food plots, or whatever it is, and you know, you've got the best setup for the rut, and there's that cold front, and the temp's right, the wind's right, but then your neighbor is doing something that is just, whether it's directly affecting your hunting or just mentally it's affecting you, that's a big factor. You've got to consider all those. The value of soil. Not that you're going to sell the soil, but the soil type in this area that you're looking, what is it? Is it good? Is it more sandy? Is it good for growing crops? Is it good for growing food plots? Because if it's not good for growing crops or food plots, then odds are it's not going to be good for wildlife. And you should see there's a direct correlation between poor soil and, you know, lower quality antlers. So, I mean, it's no secret the Midwest has the biggest, has the best soil, and they have the best antler expression in their deer. Timber value. Look at the timber. And this kind of goes back to what I was talking earlier about agents and experience and knowledge. I mean, how many times do we see a listing with, you know, one of these hunt, you know, every property that you see, every tract of land that you see gets listed. It's all game rich. It always has, you know, they always have a big buck trail camera picture. I mean, who knows where that picture came from, but they're all going to claim it's just loaded with wildlife. It's loaded with game. It's turkeys and dove and quail. It's a sportsman's paradise. It's blah, 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 blah. What do they know about the timber? What do they know about the current trees, the value? Oh, it's a great timber tract. It's future income. Well, what kind of future income are we talking about? This is how you weed out, how you weed out the good agents from the ones that don't really know everything yet. And sometimes new agents, they don't know. It's just like anything else in life. They don't know what they don't know. They don't know what to ask. But as far as timber value, what trees are planted right now? If it is a tree farm, what kind of pine trees are we talking about? Is it longleaf? Is it slash? Is it loblolly? When was it planted? What has been done? Has it been maintained? Are they doing the right things they should? Are they addressing, you know, beetle infestations? Or are they addressing kudzu? Or are they burning? Are they, you know, maintaining fire breaks? What are they doing to it? And then also the local timber market, you know, and that is driven in the South by lumber mills. We saw a lot of issues coming out of the housing market. When the housing market crashed in 2008, we saw a slew of mills, and some more mills have closed since then. Lumber mills are, it's kind of crazy, but they're so expensive to start up. The capital needed is just so great that you don't see new lumber mills fire up. It's kind of like why you don't see new mobile home parks. I know there's some every now and then, but the heyday of building new trailer parks and mobile home parks, a lot of people look at those because they're great investments. The heyday of building those in the years past for a number of reasons, but the capital, mostly driven towards capital and the cost. But because of all these lumber, you know, shutdowns, when you go to sell your trees, because the way it works essentially is that you've got a crop of trees, and you should have a value of that crop of trees. That's an asset. And asking all these questions, you should be asking your agent this, but, you know, current value of the, you know, standing crop of trees, and then what you're looking at down the road. And that is not something you can blanket across your state. It's based a lot on regions, on soil quality. Better soil is going to grow better trees, maybe a little bit quicker. Sandier soil is not as good. Pines still do well in it, but it might not be as much. And then lumber mills. I mean, there's South Carolina for the most part is seeing some good prices as far as, you know, different age classes of trees, pulp, saw, poles. There's some areas of Alabama that's seeing some tremendously low pulpwood prices. So it's all dependent on region, you know, regions, but that's driven on the lumber mills. It's driven on supply and demand. Understand that, because a lot of agents are just going to tell you, hey, you've got 200 acres of once thin 25-year-old pine trees, and it's estimated this. Well, they might not know all the ins and outs of that. Pulpwood has seen some pretty substantial changes over the past 4 years. Pulpwood's, you know, a little volatile, but, you know, it's the thing about growing and selling trees is you don't really time the market out. You got to maintain your tree crop, and you know, maintain it and thin them and clear cut them, and do it when you need to do it based on the actual crop of trees, not on the market. And that's what you need to make sure that the sellers have been doing. Projected income, I talked about that, but does the agent really know this? Is the value coming from the seller? Is it coming from the seller's forester? When you're doing all this, you know, talk, you know, if you don't already know, get some advice as far as, do you want to get yourself set up with a forester, or do you want to work with a direct timber buyer? There's some pros and cons of both, but there's some outstanding timber buyers out there that you can work with and bypass a forester. It all depends on the level of involvement you want to get into. When you're looking at buying land, you know, here's some questions to ask. Do you want to look at raw ground or turnkey property? A raw ground, meaning it's not really developed, you know, a whole lot. It hasn't really been worked for, you know, a while as far as food plots and wildlife habitat. That in general should have a lower value, should be a little bit less as far as cost. A turnkey property might be one where there's, you know, they've got green fields everywhere and deer stands they're going to convey with the property. Just like buying a house, do you want that blank canvas, or do you want something to develop yourself? Habitat work, what has the current ownership done? Are they burning? If they're burning, ask them. They know when they burned. Ask them for their burn schedule. What have they been doing? Are they doing any kind of TSI work? Are they doing anything with that? Wildlife history. Some of that, you know, you can get from the seller, but do some investigation, you know, figure out, you know, is your area, what does your area look like as far as, you know, wildlife, excuse me, populations? There's some areas across the South. There's some pockets all across the South that have a tremendously high deer per square mile populations. You've got that, you're going to have some challenges maybe growing food plots. If you just have pine trees and you're in a high density area, you're going to have a hard time growing food plots. That's something, and that's just, it's just something to consider. And also understanding, you know, turkey populations, quail populations. If you want to try to build a wild quail, well, let me rephrase that. If you want to try to build a quail property, okay, if you want to just release quail, that's fine. I mean, you can release quail on a lot of properties, just knowing that you're going to constantly have to release quail. They're not going to build, you know, pen-raised quail will not establish wild populations. There's never been one documented. But if you want to try to build a wild population that's huntable, then you need to go buy into an area that already has quail. You can't fire up a wild quail population if you don't already have the wild quail there, because pen-raised quail, released quail, they do not become wild. Yes, some will survive, but the way they're bred, their genetics, it's a different bird. They're not wild, and they're never going to survive as far as the wild population. So those are all just factors to consider and to investigate, because a lot of times, like I said before, the agents, they might not know all that. After you purchase, one of the first things you want to do is establish boundaries and roads. First, you know, I mentioned get a survey done before you close on the property. Always get a survey. Always, if there's not a recent survey on file, if there's not recent fresh markings on your boundaries, or at least just something established, T-post, pilings, whatever, pay for a survey. If you're putting all that money into your investment, pay for a survey. It will absolutely be worth the cost. When you do that, I always suggest for landowners, one of the first things they need to do is create a boundary road around your property if you can. If your boundary, you know, property line is in the middle of a swamp or a creek, that's fine. But on the nearest high ground, create a road. Get someone in there with some equipment, put a road in. those down, no pun intended, down the road will be super beneficial for burning, if you want to run a fire through there, for logging purposes, and for hunting purposes. Road systems are a tremendous value for that. And of course, put the ownership in a LLC. Talk with your CPA, talk with an attorney, probably the closing attorney, and set them up, set your property up in a LLC to protect yourself down the road if you were to, be involved in some kind of lawsuit or anything with your work, with your job, or even God forbid something happened to your property, a hunting accident, whatever it might be, do that. So these are all things to consider. And like I said before, if I could leave with just two takeaways, one is that real estate is only worth what someone's willing to pay. If a seller's not getting, $800,000 for it, they're getting $600,000, that's what it's worth at the time. And then, lastly, take it serious and ask all the questions, because it's gonna be one of the largest investments you're going to make. And reselling real estate, if you'd buy any piece of real estate and you go down and then go to resell it down the road within a couple of years, you might not break even. You might flip it, but ask those questions. Figure out who your neighbors are. Figure out, is that county-owned land that's butts up against the property, what their plans are. Are they just going to sit on it? Are they ever going to cut the trees? Are they going to build, a prison on it, or an industrial park? Stuff like that. Figure out what to do. But I'm in real estate, and I am biased, but I would say absolutely get representation. The seller, commissions have always been negotiable, and that's what this thing with this whole NAR contract is just so wild, because commissions have always been negotiated. So get representation. Have someone represent you, because even if your uncle or your father is helping you and buy real estate, they're not in the game. So have someone represent you that's qualified. Have them, when they're talking to you, they're not asking you what your goals are for the property, what you want out of the property. They're not asking you certain questions to try to figure out the best property for you. Then you might want to, interview some more. And that's what it should be. It should be an interview, to try to figure out, where you need to be as far as properties, and what your goals are. So thanks for listening. I'll see y'all next week.